Welcome back. Hour number two. Three different guests tonight, usually, and we try to always bring you information and experiences of people that are often fascinating. They always fascinate me. And remember, I'm the one who wants to learn as much as anybody, and I do. I've learned for a long time, thanks to the wonderful people we've had on this program. Doug and Bertie, B-E-R-T-I, Bertie, perhaps T-I-E, Lockhart are our guests this hour. Are you there, Doug? Can you hear me all right?
We are, Jeff. We can hear you loud and clear all the way from
Very
Ohio.
Good. Hi, Bertie.
Hi.
Thank you for being here. What I'd like to do, if I might, and we're titling this the hour, the name of the book that Doug and Bertie put out. It's been some years now, a little over 10 years. Souls of the Asylum. It's a hardcover book, and we're going to talk about that book, too. They've been, they've had some unfortunate mischief involving their book sales. Huh? Not the only people. We'll talk about that. If you don't mind, I'd like to read the description for the book, because it sets this whole thing up pretty well. Can I read that? Is that all right?
You can. Go right ahead.
All right. It's somewhere around 3 a.m. on a chilly March morning. You are curled deep within your bed and even deeper within the realm of sleep. Suddenly, you are shaken from this peaceful moment by a loud voice that says very plainly, "Wake up!" As you lie very still, willing your heart to slow back down to normal, you become aware of voices around you. Who are these voices? What are these voices? Who are they speaking to? Each voice determined to be heard, each one wanting to give an account, to tell a story. All of their stories are very different, except for one common thing. The endings all seem to be the same. You realize that you are in the middle of a conversation, somewhere between reality and sleep, somewhere between the physical and the non-physical. Is this a dream? Is part of this a dream and part of it real? If so, which is which? You began to listen closer and to wake up. You have heard detailed information about the lives of individuals who lived over 100 years ago, and all are speaking of their experiences in an Ohio lunatic asylum. Then the conversation moves from past to present, and suddenly they are speaking to you. They begin to involve you in this conversation and ask for your help. Could you do what is asked of you? Could you make sense of all this? Discover the people and their stories who have been independently verified as they unfold? And this story now becomes a quest. Find out how an Ohio blacksmith, Doug, and his family, Bertie, accept this challenge and begin an unforgettable journey between the present and the past. The book is Souls of the Asylum. And I was talking to Doug earlier today, and if that doesn't get your interest up in a book, nothing will. That's pretty wild. Doug? Let's start at the beginning on this. This is what we talked about earlier. It's just fascinating. Anything you want to say about that very well-written exposition about the book and how this started for you personally?
I do, Jeff. That really got my interest up. I want to thank you for having a platform that people can, talk about things that are untalkable in many circles or just difficult to talk about.
They're off limits for a lot of people for various reasons. Right. I understand, and it's my pleasure. Believe me, I love hearing about these things. We know so little about this planet and life as it really is. It's all been hidden from us. You know the game, and all of you listening, you understand, or you wouldn't be here listening. We're lied to constantly. We're not told anything to speak of. They won't even tell us the planet's been visited forever by other intelligent life forms. Come on, this is a joke. Go ahead.
Well, maybe for another time. We can't even decide if it's round or flat either, can we?
There you go.
But
there you go.
That's for another story. But I think it's important that I would share a little bit of our backstory, because that gives incredible validity to what happened to us. And so I would like to give a little bit of my where how I got here today, and then how Birdie is involved also. Now, my whole story is nothing but, I mean, my whole life is nothing but stories. So every bullet point that I mentioned tonight is, there's an unbelievable amount of stories related to those, and they're very important. And as we go through and we recount some of these, we're going to start to document them more efficiently, because they're so unbelievable, but we actually lived through them. So to start with me, I was born back in the mid-1900s.
I hear you.
I love to say that. This sounds too cool, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's cool. I agree.
So I was raised in the state of Maryland, and we had no religion. I had a single mom and three siblings.
Wow.
And you go to the state of Maryland, and you can still look this up today, and you look in the Board of Education. I still hold the record for the absolute worst student. My picture comes up. I hold that record today. I couldn't function in public school. I found out that I can read, but I have a difficulty in comprehending, because I don't learn the way that structured learning is. I learn visually. So
got it.
To look from words or listening or whatever, I learn with a photographic memory by watching your hands. That's my method of learning. So regular public school was very difficult for me. I struggle to read. I absolutely don't like to read. I don't like to read a book, because when I was a kid, anytime you'd get a book out, it means it's time to go to bed. It's story time, go to sleep. So if
I get the negative association, yeah, I got it.
Right. My brain automatically goes, well, it's nap time, and I'll fall asleep, regardless of it. So that's the way I was programmed. I don't like to read. Somebody will walk into my shop and they go, hey, have you ever read this book? And I said, yeah, probably not likely. Does it have pictures? Because if it has pictures, I might have seen it. But I don't. If it's just the story, I don't do that. So that's important. I don't write. I struggle to form a sentence. I told my son-in-law the other day, if he were to pin me on the ground and threaten to choke me, if I would tell him what an adjective is, he'd kill me, because I have no idea what an adjective is. It's just not part of my who I am. I lived in
a lot of people, Doug, thank you for sharing that. A lot of people would be embarrassed, ashamed. They wouldn't talk about that. That's being very forthright and frank, and that's honest.
Well,
please, it's good.
I'm the ultimate art student. I'm wired totally different than many people I've ever met. But why I'm telling you this is, it's so important to what happened to us, because I'm actually doing things that I'm not capable of doing. And I'm here to tell you that. And that's what brings such validity and importance to this, to what we experienced. I was actually in a time period where I was chased by truant officers. And many people remember them from the Little Rascals. Well, I actually was at the tail end of that. And their whole job was to take me to school or to take me to reform school. That's how bad my schooling was.
Wow.
My mother and my grandmother dabbled in paranormal things. I'm going to call it that. The children were never around that. It was always at night. They would do seances or readings. I don't know what that was about. They also involved the Ouija board. I remember that. So my guess is the experience they had was negative. I wrote it off as a young person as they were witches or crazy or whatever it was, that I just didn't want a part of it. And I grew up that way and then left home when I was 17.
Mom and grandma, you thought that they were witches. Okay, I understand. You know, when one opens the door, and the late, wonderful Brad Steiger, author of nearly 200 books on the paranormal, was a regular on this program for 10, 12 years at least. And we used to warn people, Doug and Birdie, don't mess with Ouija boards.
Oh,
don't do it. Don't open that door. Don't do it.
We highly support that. Here's one thing that's very disturbing is if you go to any store, Walmart or Target or something like that, and you go into the aisle of there's Candyland and there's chutes and ladders and there's card games and there's the Ouija board, and it's mixed right in there with games and toys. Where young people have access to it, and it's super. I have always felt, and I still believe to this day, that it is nothing more than just a doorway to a bad place, to the underworld.
It's a portal to evil, I think.
Right. We highly agree with that, yes. Encourage people to stay away from that.
Yeah.
So I want to jump ahead to, I left home when I was 17. There's a whole bunch of stories in between there, but now I'm 28, and I just got married. I was shoeing horses, draft horses. I was farming and logging with horses. And I really felt my life should be better than it was. I was deeply unhappy inside. And I just thought, well, you know what it must be is I don't have a relationship with who made me. So I was never raised in a church. And I just was living this very conservative lifestyle because I felt that was healthy and the best for me. And I found a Mennonite church that was close to us. And I started to attend. And I felt that they were living a life that agreed with what I was looking for, searching, that sort of thing. And I became immersed in them for the next 20 years. I became a Sunday school teacher and did all of the good boy Mennonite stuff and lived that life for a long time. Then my marriage fell apart. I had two children. My marriage fell apart, and that I had to leave the church, step down from all my responsibilities, and I'm now walking around in these uncharted world again with, you know, all alone. And that's when I met my lovely wife, Bertie, who is going to tell you, we bring you up to that point. Bertie is suffering with a head cold today, so she may sound a little stuffy, but I want to tell you how, or to have her tell you how we came up to this point of where we met.
Very good. Great.
So, good evening, everyone. So, Doug and I met through, really, it's kind of a lovely story, but that's for another day. It was through his father that we met. I lived across the street from him in Florida, and that's how I met Doug. When both of our marriages, that we were married 20 years prior to that, you know, with a different person, and so our other partners, and our journeys ended with them, and so our life crossed because he asked me to come help him with his blacksmith shop and
marketing.
Help him with marketing, and I thought, is this guy crazy? I don't need another job, you know. And he said, if you help me get a bridge job, Bertie, I can help you quit one of your part-time jobs. And I said, okay, you have my attention. So I came up here and started helping with the blacksmithing marketing.
Now hold on, Bertie. For all of you out there, he did say to her, a bridge. Bridge. This is important.
He did.
Go
he
ahead.
Did. It was a bridge job. And so we came, you know, we started dating and came together as a family. I had a daughter from my previous marriage, and Doug had a daughter and a son from his previous marriage. It came together as a family, and we got married in February 9, 2009. And I grew up with my mom being an energy worker, and she could speak to spirits, and she could hear them at a very young age and throughout her whole life. So to me, it was normal, you know, to have that in my life. And when I married Doug and I had checked out books from the library in Little Logan, Ohio here, I was really surprised that they had spiritual books. I was always learning and growing with spiritual stuff. And Doug saw the books and he said, who are you? I don't know you. This is right after we got married. And I thought, oh, no. I just had to, you know, read those books in secret because I, unlike Doug, like to read and love to read still. So we started. We were in, but that was February 9, 2009, and exactly 2 weeks after that, right after our wedding, a friend of ours invited us to enter a local artist contest in Athens that was to enter artwork in the roundabout.
Okay, so in there was a local invitation to artists to do a sculpture for a roundabout that was coming up in Athens. And I know this is going to sound jumping back a lot, but it's important on the details. So this is in Athens. It's below us. If I were ever in the Mennonite church and I would mention, hey, I've got to go to Athens to do a railing job or to do a measurement, they would stand up and they would say, okay, we come up front. We're going to put a prayer circle around you and put our hands on you, because everybody in this area just thinks that Athens is not a good place to go. So I had that in my head, right? I'm within the circle of being qualified to enter into this contest. And many times inspiration comes to me at night. So I have a sketchbook and a pen beside the bed. I'll wake up, and this happened again. Automatically, I woke up. I had this vision of a big, beautiful sculpture of the window grills, which are cast iron, at the asylum in Athens. So in Athens, it's very important historically. You've got the Athens Lunatic Asylum on the top of the hill, which has a tremendous amount of history. And then you've got the OU University, which is a very large university in Ohio. But there's a division between them. There's a wooded division, so you can't see either from either location. So
how far? Half a mile of woods? Quarter mile of woods? What?
No, maybe a quarter of a mile, but just enough of a buffer that my intention was to be able to pull the history off the hill, put it in people's daily vision so that they could drive around it and remember the asylum and how important it was to the community and what have you. And that was my goal. I was going to make a huge, like a 15-foot collage of these window grills, which are very decorative.
See, Jeff, what Doug didn't know is that he had been channeling all along his entire life, but didn't know he was channeling. And that's why he woke up at 3 a.m. with all kinds of ideas, or if he sat in the bathtub, he just was flooded with information of ideas and answers to all these problems that he had.
Now, I would do it on a regular basis. I just thought, man, this is just the way my creative head works or something. I didn't realize what was happening.
Got it. Understand.
Okay.
So for some reason, real quick, an awful lot of these dead souls who used to be at the asylum focused on you.
Right. So what I did was, I said, well, let's go to Athens. Or no, Bertie, I said, here's what I want to do. And Bertie says, well, let's go to Athens and take photos. Well, I was ingrained in my head that we just don't want to go down there. It's not a really friendly place or whatever. It's a spiritual bad place. It's a place I didn't really want to go. I said, I can get online and I'll just draw the pictures off of it. She says, no, it's a beautiful day in February. Let's go.
And I begged them, because I wanted to go to the asylum, because I feel energy and I have seen spirits and in the past, in my past when I was younger. So I was not afraid of them. So that's why I begged them to go.
So off we went, February, took our 12-year-old daughter, Danielle.
March 1st, yeah.
And it was a beautiful February day. We didn't even need a coat, just a heavy shirt. And I'm walking around the asylum, and the photographs were just, the lighting was perfect. It was really beautiful. And so I asked, Bertie didn't want to get out of the car, and she said she didn't feel that well. And I said, okay, well, I'm just going to go and take some quick pictures. And I'd go to different locations, took some pictures. I actually said this to her. I said, you know what? If I get back home and I'm looking at these pictures and there's like a daggone face looking out that window, I'm going to lose my stuff here, right? And I actually said that to her.
So, and I'm thinking to myself, he has no idea how many are around us right now, because I felt them all. They were all around us. They were so excited that we were there because they could feel them, and they knew that Doug was going to help them. It's like all this incredible amount of different emotions that I felt. That's why I got sick because at the time I didn't know how to handle all the energy.
There was a lot of sadness, loneliness,
mm-hmm. and desperation, and yet there was happiness and joy that we were there to help them.
The entire place is it's a huge complex, and it's completely abandoned. There's 99%. There was some university activity going on, but mostly abandoned buildings. So
is there a caretaker there now, Doug, or somebody overnight?
No, now it's so the entire complex was sold to the mm-hmm. university for $1. Now the university's taking it over, and part of the buildings are art departments or administration offices and things like that. So they're actually storing it very slowly, and they're getting it. They're taking care of it, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. All right, so I get back in, and Bertie's face is very pale and ashen. And I said, "Well, look, let's go around to the front of the building where the admission office was, which is very ornate. And I actually just wanted to see the architecture inside." But they've got this art display in there, and I'm not into modern art. It's just I'm a very traditional person. This is just Doug talking. I don't mean to offend anybody. I'm just not into contemporary stuff. And I didn't want to pay money to go in and look at contemporary stuff. So anyway, it was warm, and I said, let's go inside, and you can take a chance to walk. So we go in, and it only took me like 4 minutes to go through the gallery because it wasn't my thing. And Danielle, our daughter, and I, we're going to go and see if we can just walk around the staircases, get some photos of the early architecture, that sort of thing.
That's mm-hmm. where all the children surrounded me inside the building.
Bertie's lips started turning blue, and she says, I need to go to the bathroom. So she left and went into the bathroom. I thought she was going to be sick, and she comes out, and she was very pale, or she was seriously struggling. And I said to Danielle, come on, let's go. Let's get her home. We get her in the van. We drive toward the sea. This is important. We drive maybe less than a quarter of a mile, and I'm looking to my left for traffic. I'm getting ready to turn to the right. The minute my tires hit the road and we got off of the complex, I hadn't quite straightened out the van, and she said to me, so what do you want to do for lunch? Do you want pizza?
Oh.
And my head jerked over and looked at her because I thought I was taking her to the ER, and she was all of her color was back, her lips were perfect again, and I said, what just happened here? Because I didn't really understand.
Well, I couldn't explain mm-hmm. it to him because he had already told me and expressed to me weeks before that he didn't understand why I would get spiritual books to read, like Sylvia Brown and, you know, stuff like that.
I had no mm-hmm. clue. Mm-hmm. All right, that mm-hmm. brings us up to that night. We go home after we had pizza. We go home, we're in bed, we're asleep. And 3 a.m, I wake up, the room is dark, and I heard voices. We lived back in the country, and we shouldn't hear voices.
You said there was a bulletin that was so black.
Yeah, the way I can explain that, as it did in the book, there was a chalkboard in my imagination that was so black. It was black, the blackest you can imagine black. Mm-hmm. And the two words, wake up, hit that blackboard, and they were so white that the contrast between the two physically shook my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up, and that's when I started to wake up, and I started hearing voices in the room. So I reached over and I shook Bertie awake and I told her, and
he was literally shaking.
Yeah, I was really scared, trembling, and I kept telling her I knew we shouldn't have gone. I knew we shouldn't have gone. I just felt that
some people came home with you. It sounds like
they did.
Oh yeah, they certainly did because
were they mumbling or were they clearly audible? Could you understand them?
No, they were mumbling. Mm-hmm. I couldn't understand it, but I knew people were talking in our room, and it was a mm-hmm. pretty good-sized room. I felt they were at the one end of it.
So I went and got our daughter, Danielle, who, you know, and I said, Danielle, she was about,
13
at the time, and I said, Danielle, come pray with me and Papa because he's scared, and I said, it's just spirits, it's okay, they're fine. You know, I said, I felt them at the asylum. So we started praying, and I asked them to calm down, and I said, just just tell me what you hear. And I said, better yet, grab this notebook that he always had, a notebook by the bed, remember? So I said, start writing what you hear. So we started a conversation, and they said they were Ted's group. And they started, like, I would ask questions in my mind, and then Doug would start writing the answers in the paper. Like, I wasn't even saying them out loud. So I knew that they were hearing me, the spirits, and then Doug started calming down.
It took a while. I mean, I my eyes were so full of tears, and I was trembling. I couldn't put this all together. I was really totally frightened. But I could see them. They were in a circle or semicircle with their backs to me. And when they realized that I was aware of them, one or two of them turned towards me, and that's when I couldn't hear their words, but I could write their words. Like, it's very odd how this whole thing started. So I started to write their words down, and then Birdie would ask questions, and then all of a sudden I was writing things, and that's when she said she was asking questions in her head that I was answering. It was kind of a...
That's wild. Now, you were not a great practicer of penmanship either, right?
No.
Not at all. So the original manuscript and process of all of this, we have still, and it's actually many volumes of spiral notebooks. Many, I don't know.
Because
like
in between
12
all the,
or 15.
In between all the stories and how they told us, you know, that we... They wanted to, they said, you can help us with what we need with your hands, Doug and Bertie. You felt this at the asylum, and that's why we came. And we knew that you knew that we were okay.
And together, our light.
Yeah, they said your light was bright, and we just followed you, and you agreed to help us. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, you agreed to help us. We're called Ted's group, and only because there's a... gentlemen in the non-physical side, there's a group of us that haven't moved over, crossed over all the way into the heavenly realm. That
so these people died maybe 100 years ago, but they're in between. They never completed
correct.
The journey across. They're still here. They're hanging around. I can see how that would be with people who are in a lunatic asylum. I understand. Stress,
so,
tremendous raw emotion, all kinds of things. Go ahead.
Sure.
So over the next few days when things calmed down and at 3 in the morning, it seemed like 3 in the morning every morning I would wake up, and that's when this whole dialogue would start. We would start writing. But when I could calm down and just start to focus, I said, okay, I'm just going to write what I hear. What we found out was this, was a very interesting journey for me. At this moment, I'm not really speaking. All I'm doing is using my vocal cords, and I'm making a series of noises. And those noises are traveling to your eardrum, and they're vibrating in a manner that you can interpret into some knowledge, understanding. And so if, like, say, for instance, if a person that can't speak English and just Russian, like, say they're a Russian person, they can't speak English and I'm speaking English, what I'm saying just sounds like noise. It's nothing they can understand.
It's a different vibration.
Right. It's a different kind of vibrational understanding. So we found out that in the spirit world, they vibrate at a different way that I wasn't able to understand yet. So a man steps up, and his name is Ted. His full name is Theodore. We found that later, Theodore Mon. And he said, I will be the in-between for you. And so here's what would happen. If I would wake up at 3 in the morning with my notebook, And my eyes were closed, and I would see it. I would see a wall, and on top of this wall, which was very short, maybe like 2 feet, there was a shower curtain, like a long shower curtain. So I could see movement on the other side, but I couldn't make out. I could see that it was human form, but I couldn't see details. Well, in that shower curtain, there was a split, and that split was peeled back just a little bit.
Right.
There's a bright light on the other side. So one of those shapes would move into that bright light, and then I could tell if it was male or female or child or whatever. And then this fella, Ted, was sitting in a chair sideways, one ear to that person and one ear to me. And so they would tell him something, and then he would tell me, and then I'd write it down.
Because he was on the same vibrational level as Doug.
Yeah, he was able to take that vibration and make it into something I could understand. Because to me, it all sounded like a very high-pitched squeal, almost, when anybody was speaking. And that has since changed. Yeah, that was in the beginning, because I didn't know how to interpret that.
Right.
Okay?
Okay. Yeah.
So then we ended up with three of these really amazing detailed stories. And they would start out like this. Hi, my name is so-and-so. I was born this time. I died at the asylum, and this time I'm buried under stone number 454. And this is my story. And I would write it down. And this is very interesting because I could write, I think the longest I wrote was 40 minutes.
Yeah.
I never lifted my pen off of the paper other than to turn the page.
Huh.
I made absolutely no mistakes, and there was no pause.
Yeah, he just wrote so fast that I was just
amazed. Was he printing, or was this cursive writing? He doesn't do cursive.
He was mainly printing, but now that you say that, one of the stories that he, when he was channeling their stories, it was a female that came through, and she said, she started writing, and I knew it was a female, and I looked down and I said, oh my, that's cursive. Well, Doug doesn't know how to write cursive.
That's another sidebar to my education. I remember the above the chalkboard in grade school, there was a printed letter and there was a cursive letter, and I spent exactly 3 or 4 days on the cursive letters, and then we never talked about it again in school. So I never learned how to do that other than to write in script.
So she was thinking, the spirit was thinking in cursive, and you were transcribing in cursive.
I have no idea how that works.
They just use his hand to write their story. Some of the stories written differently, like the handwriting was different, but it was all print.
One time I wrote with my left hand.
Mm-hmm. When there was a little girl.
One time I wrote with my right hand, and then, I'm right-handed. But then one time I wrote with both hands at the same time, and that is pretty freaked out for me. I mean, because my left hand is, it is a great tong holder, but it doesn't, I have no eye-hand coordination. I can't write with my left hand. So, anyway, to the extent of that, when my son came home from school, he was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and he had homework to do, and it was cursive writing. And I went into the other room, and I confided with Birdie, this is something we'd never talked about, and I asked her if she could help our son with his homework, and she said, why? And I said, because it's with cursive, and I didn't know how to write cursive, and I didn't want to teach him or show him something that he'd get in trouble for. And she never knew that, but she didn't embarrass me, and she went and helped him with his homework, but she knows that I can barely read cursive, and I can't write it. Mm-hmm. And here I was writing a full story in cursive. Okay, so we have three of these stories, and I get three of these stories done, and I ask, okay, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, what are we doing here? And Ted said this, you're going to take these three stories, you're going to pack them up, you're going to go down to Ohio University, you're going to go into the Alden Library, you're going to go up on the 5th floor, you're going to walk, get off the elevator, turn to the right, go through the double doors, and talk to the man at the main desk.
The archivist.
And I said, that's not going to happen. And Birdie was there. And I said, look, I'm a professional person in my community. I'm respected. Yeah. I don't want to be known as the blacksmith that's hearing voices, because that's never a good thing when you start hearing voices in my realm, right? I didn't want to be known as that. Let's go buy something from the guy that's hearing voices. I said, I'm not going to do it. And they said, okay, but you're just not going to get any sleep. And I said, that's just not fair. So packed up, we went down to Athens. I'd never been on the campus other than to the asylum. So we're lost driving around on the campus. We find this library, we park.
Did you bring them all?
They were in a spiral notebook. And Ted had said this specifically. He said, you're going to present this work to him. He's going to listen with folded arms, and then he's going to open his arms and embrace your work. That was his written words. Okay. So I had that in my head. So we go in, get on the elevator, get off the elevator. We turn into this lobby, and what is in the – there's some display cases in this lobby, and it's on all original artifacts from the asylum that closed in 93.
Not a coincidence.
I thought, okay, that's weird. Both of our eyebrows went up. We open up the door. We go in. There's nobody around. There's this fella standing there, and he looks like a professor, dude. He's doing a crossword puzzle. There's nobody around. And I walk up to him, and I said, you the head fella around here? And he goes, I think that's me. And I said, is there a place we could talk? He looked around. There was nobody in his place. Mm-hmm. He goes, we can talk right here. And I was so embarrassed. I said, no, like a private place. He says, okay, you can come back here in my office. So we go back in his office. We sit down. I have these books in my hand, the original manuscript. Mm-hmm. And he is sitting in an office chair that rocks, and he's got his arms folded. And he says, what can I do for you? And I said, well, here it is. I'm hearing voices. And I wrote down these stories, and I was told to bring them to you. That's all I know. And he goes, what? And I said, I just told you. That's all I know. And so I give him one of the stories. He says, let me see. So he's reading them through his glasses, and he actually had his arms folded. He's reading them through his glasses. He looks over his glasses a couple times at me, and I'm starting to shake and sweat because I thought, oh, my gosh, he thinks I'm crazy. I have no idea where I am or why I'm doing this. And he reads about 10 or 15 pages, and he stands up, and he says, can you give me a minute? I'll be right back. And he walked out with my manuscript, right? And I said to Bertie, I stood up and I got my coat off the back of the door, and I said, let's go, let's get out of here, because he's calling campus security or the police or something. You know, we've got to get out of here. Calm down. Yeah. I said, no, we've got to leave. So I finally sit down, calm down. He comes back in. I'm shaking like a leaf. And he goes, can you tell me again where you got these stories? And I said, I told you. I heard it in my head. He said, no, seriously. I said, look, I have no idea what you do, why I'm here. I was told to bring these to you. And he says, you have no idea what I do? I said, I got no idea. He says, I am the head archivist for all of the sealed asylum medical records.
Oh, my.
And I need to know who let you into the vault to get this information. And I said, dude, I had no idea what you did. I didn't know anything about a vault. I didn't go in no vault. I told you I heard these in my head. And he says, do you have more of these? I said, yeah, I got like three of them. He says, can I see them? I said, here, take them. You can look at them all. You can take them all. I was shaking like a leaf. I was crazy. He started thumbing through them, and then he opened his arms, and that's when he embraced our work.
He invited
us. Over a number of times, he started going back into the vault and cross-referencing dates and details that I should have never known, because this is sealed.
Sure.
Even 110 years is sealed medical forever records. And so he verified these first three stories. He actually was involved in a paranormal group. He invited us to go to a couple meetings. That's something that just country people don't do.
This is getting to be really, this is wild. You must have blown his mind. And then when he collected himself, he knew there's something big going on here.
Yeah. So this gets even crazier and crazier. And have us back as many times because it's going to be a lot.
Jeff, this gentleman's group, I'm not going to say any names at this time, but
no need.
This gentleman's group actually Ted's group told us that they had been preparing for a couple of years to help us move spiritually way ahead of where we needed to be, because they wanted us to move quicker on this. So they helped us really grow spiritually really fast. You know, they were just like a great mm-hmm. teacher for us. And then mm-hmm. they were so, at the same time, they were so intrigued with all of the gifts that Doug just embraced overnight. Because remember, mm-hmm. Doug had the tunnel vision and I don't want anything to do with this. And then once Doug accepted that one gift of channeling and receiving this information and accepted the challenge to help this group, mm-hmm. you know, place markers, because they said, we just really want you to tell our story, write a book, tell our story and the truth to be known. And then we want you to start placing markers with names, birthdays, death dates, and bring awareness to the atrocities that happened.
Markers,
and they said, we don't want a name.
Yeah, they wanted markers, everyone. They wanted markers on their graves in this immense cemetery. Go ahead.
That wasn't our idea. That was their idea. So we didn't really know mm-hmm. what we agreed to or the purpose behind this. And what it was to show people that these people were people before they became patients at the asylum. And we want to talk about the asylum for a few minutes because this is very interesting. In 1868, the cornerstone for this asylum was set. And so we're talking in 1865, the war between the states ends. So there was discussion of, you know, a need for a facility. So they started it in 1868. 1873 is when they opened it. And what it was used for was for an in-between a hospital and a prison. And so this Kirkbride way of healing was for different therapies and farming and open air and that sort of thing. Being labeled the lunatic asylum is very misrepresentative, because we found out through the stories and through other information that there's a vast reason that you could be put in there. And one reason was if you were homeless, if you were a vagrant, so you weren't sick, you couldn't go to the hospital, you did nothing mm-hmm. wrong, mm-hmm. you can't go to prison. Right. So what do they do with you? They thought, well, we could help feed him, clothe him. He could work on this humongous farm. He could get himself together and get back. We had a reason. Let me explain a couple more reasons.
Whoop. We'll get him right back. Fascinating story. I'm still not sure who Ted is, how he figures in this. Sounds like he was shepherding this group. A lot of people went through that facility and didn't leave fully when they died. And there's this huge cemetery. None of them had name markers, and they wanted the dignity of having a marker on their final resting place with their names. This is fascinating. Okay, go ahead, Doug. We got
you back. We're back.
Yeah.
Some of the other reasons I was mentioning for a reason to go into the asylum was we had one of the people, she was 9 or 10 or something like that. She was, her mother was making apple butter. She reached on the stove, tipped over the apple butter, it burned her face and her chest, and she was disfigured. So in that time period, you know, she was socially unacceptable. She stayed in the asylum for 30 or more years and died there. There was an account that a woman went to the asylum every 28 days she was admitted. There were people in there for postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. There was a Civil War veteran that was in there because he couldn't sleep at night.
Yeah.
He could function during the day, but he couldn't sleep at night for his nightmares. So
PTSD.
It wasn't just It wasn't severe mental disorders, but there was a vast reason that you could be in the asylum. So our story writers wanted people to know that they were buried without the dignity of their name. they're just under a headstone. So Bertie and I started a nonprofit organization to, what we wanted to do is in this cemetery, there's over 2,000 graves, and the headstones are a numbered headstone, and the number refers to their patient number.
And at the time we started,
their burial number.
At the time we started this project, there were over 2,000 markers in the three cemeteries, mm-hmm. and out of those, 1,777 were marked with only just a number.
Right. And so our proposal was we were going to get donations and pay for them a small headstone that would have their given name and their last name, their birth date, their death date, and their burial number. Now,
this is a new monument, all right, for each grave you're talking about, a headstone, each one.
Correct. Now, it's ground level, and it's in mm-hmm. front of the upright limestone stone that's there now.
The historical marker would stay there.
Yeah, we were going to keep the historical aspect. The problem here is when the mowers go through there, when they go through there, they're clipping some of them, they're leaning, and if they get broke off, then there's no record of where this person is buried.
Gotcha.
So the people were, that. This is what they asked us to do. And I want to move on with our story before we get back to this, because we ran into an incredible amount of resistance. I'm super glad that you're bringing this back up, because I think Bertie and I, the people that were blockading us have moved on, and I think that the doors are open that we can continue to go back to the cemetery and fulfill what mm-hmm. we're asked to do, and we'll talk about that. Okay, so we have, we were told that there's 110 physical people in Ted's group that has reincarnated and working on the physical realm to get this project done. Bertie and I included. There's 177 souls in the non-physical that have not moved on that are there to do the behind the scenes or tell their story or what they're doing on that side. So Bertie and I go to the Athens Historical Society, and we discover that there's a handwritten book that corresponds with a name and the death date of every stone in that cemetery. So it is now historical public record.
So it's not locked away in this vault. It is accessible.
It is. Exactly, okay. And that's important for our argument.
Right.
So I open this great big book, and for sure it's written in old-timey cursive, mm-hmm. and I'm struggling mm-hmm. with it. And I wanted to know who was in Ted's group on the non-physical through these 2,000 names, and so I couldn't read them. It was taken forever. So I just put my hand on the book, and I'm running down, and then I would get this like a little bit of electric charge, like a static charge in my hand, and I would stop, and I would look, and I would say, okay, here's the name, and here's the number, and we'd write it down. And it was taking a long time to do this. So they said, listen, let me just give you a list of the numbers. And so I got in my head a list of numbers. I wrote down all the numbers of Ted's group. And mm-hmm. I'm coming down with my hand, and all of a sudden I hit 284, the number 284. And I got this, and it shook me again. It really affected my heart. I became very emotional. It was difficult to breathe. And so I wrote down on my paper, what was that? And then the response was, sorry, that's for later. We'll talk to you about that later.
Wow. Continue. And when you look at the cover of the book, Souls of the Asylum, and you'll see that under Doug and Bertie's names, you can take a trip right to it. And 284 is right on the cover.
There's
a lot of other markers back of it. That's it. These people, a lot of them, were buried without dignity. That's the problem here, right?
Yep.
And they
were
hanging around. They just wanted dignity before moving on. That sounds like what we're We'll pick this up next visit. This is really a fascinating story. There's so much going on here. Doug and Bertie, thank you for sharing. We'll talk
Thanks
again soon. Keep it up. This is great.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you both very much for sharing. It's a fascinating story. There's more to
Thank
life
you.
Than the controllers will ever tell us.
That's
so don't do it. Yep. All right. Good night, you two. Take care.
Good night.
All right. And we will be back with more in just a few minutes. Hold on.